Good evening. My name's Charles Godfrey. I'm director of the Oxford Martin School, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you to the fifth James Martin Lecture, a lecture in which we commemorate the memory of James Martin. Jim Martin was a computer and information scientist who wrote presciently about the challenges faced by humanity in the 21st century, both natural challenges and challenges associated with technology. Jim, with an enormous generosity, endowed the Oxford Martin School with a challenge to the university to do major work to address the major challenges that mankind, humanity, will face over the coming decades. It's a great delight that we retain a close contact with the Martin family. And I'm really pleased to say that Jim's wife, Lillian, and Lillian's daughter, Jayron, are in the audience with us this evening. So our speaker this afternoon is Paul Nurse. And Paul is one of the UK's most distinguished scientists. He's a geneticist, a cell biologist, whose work on the cell cycle, the proteins that control the cell cycle, led to him being awarded with Leland Hartwell and Tim Nurse the 2001 Nobel Prize. This work is of fundamental importance, fundamental basic science importance, because the mechanisms are conserved all the way from yeast up to humans. And because of that, it is of great medical significance as well, especially around cancer. Paul is not only a scientist, but an extraordinary science leader. And if I stood here and said everything he's done over the last 20 years, there'd be no time for his lecture. So I'm just going to mention a few things. Beginning slightly parochially, he was a chair in the 1980s, I think, of our Department of Microbiology here. He's been president of Rockefeller University in New York. He's been president of the Royal Society. And he was one of the people who conceived of the extraordinary Francis Crick Institute at King's Cross in London, and is its first director and chief executive. Paul has done a huge number of things in government, including the review that led to the restructuring of the research councils and the creation of UKRI. On television and radio, Paul is a fabulous and, might I say, sometimes slightly wicked performer, a doughty defender, both of good science and the importance of supporting science. Tonight, Paul is going to tell us what is life. Paul.
Well, thank you, Charles, for that introduction, and thank you all for coming. It's a complete honour to speak in the Sheldonian and also to speak back at the university where I spent 5 years, it's true, in the 1980s, a long time ago. A pleasure also to meet Lillian Martin. Can I just tell you, it's a wonderful school, the Martin School, taking on big problems and putting together interdisciplinary approaches to solve them. So thank you and your family for enabling that and allowing it to happen. So I'm going to talk about, well, what is for me one of the most fundamental questions in biology, perhaps the most fundamental really, which is what is life? It's only three words. It's very easy to ask that question, but actually it's not so easy to answer it. There's a bewildering diversity of life on our planet. All around us, there are bacteria, fungi, plants, animals, and of course ourselves, human beings. The living organisms found on Earth are physical entities that maintain themselves, grow, self-organize, reproduce, making more copies of themselves. But what is it which links these different life forms all together? For example, what do we have in common with this yellow brimstone butterfly behind me here? I like insects, I should say. I'm particularly fond of beetles. Somebody said that before, in actual fact. I'm particularly fond of beetles, but I thought in the Sheldonian a brimstone yellow would be more appropriate. And you'll see it flitting about your gardens in a couple of weeks' time. It's a harbinger of spring, and it's going to flit about my lecture a bit as well. I'll refer to it a couple of times. So what links this butterfly with us? In short, what are the core principles that underlie life? Now, I'm not the first to ask this question, of course. I should have here the first title page of a book also called What is Life? It was written by the famous physicist Erwin Schrödinger in 1944. His book was influential, if somewhat incomprehensible. We all read it. I did 50 years ago. I will quote from it, but I think we remember it in a different way from what it actually is, to be quite honest with you. Anyway, I will quote one or two passages from it, however. Now, my approach to the same question that Schrödinger asked here is to consider some of the important ideas of biology. I'll describe where they came from, explain what they are. None of these ideas are particularly new. I hope I'll be able to explain them to you in perhaps a new sort of way, but they've stood the test of time. And I want to pull on those ideas to develop these principles that are fundamental to life. I should also say at the beginning that biologists don't often talk about fundamental principles. Physicists talk about them all the time, of course. But biologists tend to like to describe details. You know, I sequence genes, and ecologists will count how many species there are in a habitat. We like making lists. But actually, from what we know about biology, there are principles, and I want to try and develop them as we go along. Now, the first idea I'm going to talk about is a simple one. It's the idea, the concept of the cell. The cell is the basic structural and functional unit of life. I call it here life's atoms. They were discovered here in Oxford. If you go down to the High Street, you'll find a plaque recording this. They were discovered by Robert Hooke, one of the founders of the Royal Society, a polymath, as many were, then an architect, designing churches in London, an artisan, an experimentalist, inventor of Hooke's law, which we all had to learn, involving springs at school. But he also discovered and described cells. And this is the picture on the your right here. Sorry, your left here. Using this microscope, which he constructed, or one like this. And what he did is he used a razor to cut slivers of cork, plant cork, then examined them under a microscope like this. And what he saw were neat arrays of boxes. He called them cells after the Latin word cella for small cubicle. It's shown here in this drawing published in 1665 in a popular book of the time called Micrographia. I put on the other side there, the yellow one, which is a scanning electron microscope picture of the same sorts of material. So these are the first cells, the basic unit of life. A few years later, a rather humble Dutch draper, Anthony von Leeuwenhoek, working in Delft in the Netherlands, scraped between his teeth, put it under a single lens microscope, which was actually a very good one, and discovered single-celled life, what we now know as a bacteria. Good. This is a picture from Leeuwenhoek. He sent this picture to the Royal Society in the 1670s or 1680s. It's rather charming. If you look at the figure B, C, D up there, obviously, under the microscope, this bacteria had done just a loop-the-loop, swimming about under the microscope. He was a bit disturbed by this discovery of these little animals, which he called animalcules. because he found them between his teeth, and he was rather proud of his dental hygiene and felt disturbed at finding little animals living in his teeth. He was a close neighbour in Delft to the painter Vermeer. And Vermeer, unusually for an artist, actually both then and now, painted pictures of a scientist. He did two pictures, and he only has about 40 in his genre. This is the one in the Louvre. Ah, now I'm getting better at it. This is the one in the Louvre called The Astronomer. I like to think that this might have been stimulated by Leeuwenhoek. There's no evidence for this, of course, pure speculation. Although when Vermeer died, Leeuwenhoek was appointed as his executor, so it's very likely that they did know each other. Let's imagine it could be Leeuwenhoek, the discoverer of single-celled life. Now, over the next two centuries, it became clear that all living organisms consisted either of a single cell or a collection of cells. And this led to the early 19th century, because it took two centuries really to sort all this out. It's quite difficult to examine living material under a microscope, particularly animal material. Over the next two centuries, it became clear that cells were everywhere. And Theodor Schwann, German zoologist here, in 1839, summarized all this up when he concluded that all organisms are composed of essentially like parts, namely of cells. There were many who contributed to this. He was one of the better publicists, so we tend to give him Schleiden and Schwann. Schleiden was a botanist, the credit for that, but it has to be said they were just better publicists, probably. But as well as cells being the basic structural unit of life, which is how we're generally taught about it at school, they are also the basic functional unit of life, as was argued by another German scientist, pathologist this time, Rudolf Virchow, who in 1858, some 30 years later, wrote that every animal, if we see up there, appears as a sum of vital units, each of which bears in itself the complete characteristics of life. What that means is that cells are living organisms themselves. They are alive. They bear the characteristics of life. He also argued that all cells come from cells, omnis cellula a cellula in Latin. That was important too, because at the time it was thought that maybe living cells just arose spontaneously in some way that wasn't fully understood. And indicating that all cells were derived from pre-existing cells by cell division was rather fundamental. If you think carefully about it, it means that there's a stream of connection between cell generations through a process of cell division that stretches back through the development of all living things, including ourselves, but also extends eventually back into deep time during the evolution of life on this planet, connected through repetitive cell division. Now, I hope I've convinced you that cells are interesting, but if you are still doubting it, I'll show you this. This is an egg being fertilized by a sperm, and perhaps I should remind you that every one of us once looked like this. We were all once a single cell. We have all been derived from a single cell, and if you're not interested anymore, there is a door over there. Now, cells are generally considered to be the simplest entities which exhibit the characteristics of life. I will talk a little more about that later. But this means understanding cells is key to understanding life. So they will figure several times quite prominently in the rest of my talk. So what can we learn about cells that is relevant to understanding life? This is a modern picture of a cell. Well, first, let's state the obvious. Cells are bounded physical entities. They are separate from their environment. They're surrounded by a semi-permeable lipid membrane, which separates them from their surroundings, but allows communication with those surroundings. This, for example, allows nutrient chemicals in the environment to become concentrated in the cell. So they're a physical entity in communication, but separate from the environment. This means, this separation, that order can be built up in cells at the expense of increasing disorder outside cells. In this way, life does not contravene the second law of thermodynamics, which states the universe as a whole moves towards increasing disorder. I mention this because when physicists think about life, they get very worried about this, and there is no need for them to worry. Life has solved the problem. It doesn't contravene this law of physics. It worried Schrödinger a bit, as you can see in this quote here. This is the first quote up here. An organism's astonishing gift of controlling a stream of order on itself and thus escaping the decay into atomic chaos. It's quite sort of exaggerated, of course, in its language, but what it implies is that that life avoids the problem of the second law of thermodynamics, and he was very, very concerned about that. But it's bound, the fact that it's bounded deals with that issue. He was astonished that life could escape that decay into atomic chaos, as he said here, and he proposed that a way of solving this was the chromosomes, which we'll come to in a moment. It could be explained in some terms of a code script, which was passed on through the generations. And that is a link to the second idea I'd like to discuss with you, and that is the gene, which explains the mysterious phenomenon of inheritance. The idea here is, of course, that the gene is the basis of heredity. It had its origins with the work of an Augustinian monk, Gregor Mendel, abbot of Brno Monastery in the now the Czech Republic. I was there a couple of weeks ago. This is Gregor. I call him the gardening monk because he did a lot of experiments with plants, crossing different plants with different characteristics to look at how those characteristics were inherited. He had quite good facilities there. I'll show you a picture of the monastery in a moment. But what Mendel did was to experiment with maybe half a dozen different plant species, but then decided to focus on one where he seemed to be able to make sense of what he was observing. I mention this because biology is complex. And if you're to make sense of the complexity, it helps greatly if you study biological material, which actually you can make sense of. Because having made sense of it, you can perhaps apply those ideas and principles to more complex situations. And you could call it cheating in a way, because you just focus on what you can make sense of. But if you don't do that, then you can never make sense of the complexity that we're looking at. So he found pea plants were good, that have different characteristics, and he analyzed the outcomes of thousands of the progeny produced in these crosses, publishing his work in 1865. I first visited his monastery in 1981. Wasn't so easy to go then, it was the height of the Cold War. And what you see here is his garden. It now looks much better when I visited it a few weeks ago. And he had a greenhouse, which was even bigger. I'm astonished that an Augustinian monastery should have invested so much time in indulging a monk's curiosity, which is essentially what was happening. They were like a little research council, really, funding research. Except he didn't have to write grants. And he didn't have to think about impact factors. He simply was studying the crosses to see what he could learn from them. He crossed peas of varied characteristics, including plants of different heights, different flower colors, different seed shapes. You see some examples up there. Now, he was trained as a physicist. He never got a degree. He was in Vienna. I'm not sure he was good at examinations, but he was good at science. But he took something from physics, which was a respect for quantitation, a respect for theory, which was rather lacking in biologists of the time. And this meant that he was very quantitative in his approach. He was very careful about how he counted and classified the different characteristics and only focused on those characteristics where he could make clear distinction. And what began to emerge out of these crosses, which had not been noticed by others who were doing similar experiments, were simple ratios. And many of us at school would have learned the ratio of, been taught the ratio of 3 to 1, for example. I won't go into it. But this eventually led these simple ratios to Mendelism, the notion that heredity is based on indivisible particles or factors which are inherited through the germ cells, like the pollen and ovules in these plants or sperm and eggs in animals. And these indivisible components, another example of just like the cell is like the structural functional unit of life, an atom, this was the unit of heredity. These factors, after Mendel, because Mendel's work was ignored, actually. He became abbot of the monastery. He got into a fight with the government about taxation and drifted off from counting his plants. And he published his work. It was actually published in a decent journal. I'm not sure what the impact factor was, but I'm sure it was moderately good. But he published there, and Darwin, Charles Darwin, who even had a copy of it, though he never read it. By the way, Darwin, Charles Darwin, also observed 3-to-1 ratios in crosses with snapdragons, but he just recorded it more like a naturalist. He didn't try to think about it. He didn't have good enough data to be sure that that ratio was absolutely clear, and he didn't try to interpret it. Now, some years after Mendel, around 25, 30 years, these factors were found to be linked to the chromosomes, which were discovered in dividing cells. Let me give you an example. This is a picture from the late 19th century from an onion root tip, showing chromosomes appearing when cells divided. I think the nice one, this one here, where you can see these threads separating. I like this particularly because I first saw cells and I first saw chromosomes in an onion-tipped squash just like this when I was 12 or 13 at school. And so it looked exactly like that, except it was in color rather than black and white. Now, these Mendelian factors are, of course, what we now call genes. And genes were one of the most important discoveries of the 20th century. And I want to say a little bit about those discoveries because it's important for developing our principles. In the 1940s, Oswald Avery in Rockefeller University, New York, which Charles mentioned I worked in for 7 or 8 years, he showed that genes were made of deoxyribonucleic acid, or DNA. It was contentious at the time. Many didn't believe it. It was published in 1944. When I went to Rockefeller, they had a cocktail party to welcome me. And this little old man came up to me and shook my hand to welcome me. And he said his name was Matt McCarty. And I looked at him and I said, "You're not the McCarty who was on Oswald Avery's paper in 1944. And he said, "Yes, I am that McCarty." He was 91 and still coming into the university. Anyway, this was not an idea that was rapidly agreed with. His own colleagues at Rockefeller were amongst his fiercest critics, by the way, typical of academics, is what we expect from our academic colleagues. But he was certainly not immediately accepted. However, come 10 years later, the next major step, which you're all very familiar with, is the structure of DNA as a double helix was determined. Involved a number of people in London, the experimentalists Rosalind Franklin, Ryan Gosling, Maurice Wilkins, and in Cambridge, Francis Crick and Jim Watson. Crick and Watson famously proposed the structure based on the other experimental evidence of the double helix that could explain heredity through the linear sequence of bases that are making up the DNA and the pairing between these complementary bases. You can see here the base adenine is pairing with thymine, guanine with cytosine. Now, this is a double helix, which is this structure allows it to be replicated. If you think of a double helix as like a twisted ladder, and then the rungs of that ladder are the paired bases, then if you if you untwist that and separate the rungs, and then you use that pairing to make a new copy, just as you see here, you get a precise copying of the genetic material. And we're all very familiar with this. It's copied during the process of cell reproduction, the cell cycle, which I spent my life studying, and accounts, of course, for heredity. It explains Schrödinger's code script, which I mentioned. It explains the permanence of the gene between generations that bothered Schrödinger, because DNA is precisely copied, or almost precisely copied, which I'll return to, every time a cell divides. Also, the sequence of bases, which encodes the information, is tucked inside the double strand here. It's kept in the middle of the DNA polymer. Crick went on with others then to propose what we call the central dogma. What is the central dogma? Such a terrible name, really, dogma. I hated it, but it's what we all know it as. It describes how the sequence of bases making up of a gene is copied from the DNA to RNA, that's ribonucleic acid. This acts as a messenger from the DNA located in the nucleus, where the chromosomes are, to the cytoplasm, where the proteins are made, the proteins being the structure of the proteins being encoded by the DNA sequence. The sequence of the messenger RNA determines the structure of those proteins. And this led in the 50s to the conclusion, 60s, to the conclusion that there's one gene for each protein. The initial work, which was done in a fungus, actually, was one gene for each enzyme. These discoveries made in the 20th century, mostly the second half, laid the foundations of what we now call molecular biology. And they are critical to understanding life. Central to it is the genetic code. Heredity is in a four-letter code made of the four bases. And one thing to emphasize here, this way of storing information is the same as linear sequences in a book, which you read, that's a linear sequence. In my talk, I'm talking to you in linear sentences, or in bytes in a computer. They are all linear ways of storing information. It means that this linear digital storage of information was invented by life probably 3 billion years before the computer age. We learnt it, if we only know where to look, from life. Well, the nature and function of the gene is an introduction to the next two ideas I'm going to talk about: life as chemistry, and then life as information. How does chemical activity and physical forces bring about life? Because life is wonderful, and yet it's based on chemistry and physics. And this is why vitalism, the idea that there was some special spark, was so prevalent. This idea that the functioning of living organisms is can be understood in terms of chemical activity and physical forces. It's an idea that can be traced back to French chemists. The initial work was done by Lavoisier just before the French Revolution. Unfortunately, his research was cut short because he met the guillotine, being a tax collector for the ancient regime. A great pity, because he was well on his way to sorting this out. But then it was handed on 50 years later or more to Louis Pasteur, who we know as the father of chemistry, but shown here in this heroic painting. Not as good as the Vermeer painting, in my view, but still a painting. And he was carrying out experiments, would you believe, on sugar beet fermentation in the north of France. It was before he was famous. And it led to the concept that life can be understood in terms of chemistry. What was he doing? Well, he was working in the north of France, where sugar beet was being used to make alcohol. And the industrialists who were doing that were worried because many of their fermentations failed, and instead of making alcohol, they made acid. And he, by just looking at the fermentations, demonstrated that for the successful production of alcohol, you needed to have yeast in there, a single-celled microbe yeast. And if you had yeast there, it would work. If there wasn't yeast there and there was bacteria, for example, then the fermentation made acid, and he concluded that it was the yeast that was critical. Now, that was an applied project, totally applied project. He was helping industry. But he went on from helping industry to making a fundamental proposal. What he concluded, more generally, was that fermentation was a physiological act yielding products for the cell. In other words, chemical reactions are an expression of the life of a cell. What he was arguing was life is chemistry. And let me, as an aside, just say that sometimes we argue a lot in our profession about the differences between discovery, basic research, translational research, applied research. They are much closer than is sometimes thought. Same principles apply, same curiosity apply. They do work in different ways. In the case of Pasteur, with what I just described to you, they were completely mingled. So Pasteur proposed life is chemistry, but it is very elaborate and special chemistry. And I want to just describe that briefly. The first point you should be aware of, that it is based on carbon polymers. And this is going to be important and links with other things I've said. We've already met carbon polymers because they make up nucleic acids, DNA and RNA, and we're now going to consider them in how they make up proteins. Before going there, though, just to sort of keep you excited, I want to remind you that carbon is central to life, but it had its origins in the centers of dying stars where it's made. Carbon comes from dying stars. We literally have our origins in the stars. Now, the substances from yeast that Pasteur was working on are proteins that act as enzymes. And enzymes catalyze chemical reactions. They make chemical reactions go faster. Proteins are polymers of amino acids based on carbon and nitrogen. The carbon atoms form part of the backbone to that polymer, and they can also link to chemically different side chains of the amino acids. This is a little bit of a protein backbone, and what I want you to see is the atoms NC, N for nitrogen, C for carbon, are providing a backbone. But then if you look, that you see you have side chains, and some of them are constant, an oxygen and a hydrogen, for example. Others, which are down here as R, vary, and they vary according to the different amino acids that are found in the protein. Now, these different amino acid side chains are chemically very different, and this is very important. Some are positively charged, some are negatively charged, some repel water, some are big, some are small. There's 20 different amino acids that make up proteins. There's only 4 different nucleotides that make up nucleic acids. And we'll come back to that when I talk a bit more about principles. Here are some examples of the different amino acids and their different potential for different chemistry, being positively charged like lysine or negatively charged like aspartate. This results in a wide variety of chemistry that can produce elaborate structures which have the ability to carry out many and varied different chemical reactions. And this contrasts with DNA, which is stable, is not chemically diverse. In fact, it's chemically rather dull, which is why Avery's colleagues at Rockefeller opposed his ideas. It just wasn't interesting chemistry. Proteins do have interesting chemistry. Now, the chains of amino acids making up these protein polymers can fold up in many ways to make complex molecular structures. Here we have a protein. It's got a couple of hundred different amino acids, and it's starting to fold, to make connections between different amino acid residues that make it up. And this generates a three-dimensional molecular structure that is derived from a one-dimensional chain, which in turn is derived from a one-dimensional chain, a linear information device. And I emphasize, so here we have a three-dimensional structure. Now, these varied structures combined with varied chemistries is the reason why we and all living things can undertake a wide diversity of chemical reactions because of the huge variety of enzymes that can be produced. And they produce, these chemical machines, a huge variety of chemicals that are needed for us to operate, for all life to operate. They make new molecules, they break them down, they recycle them, they generate molecular assemblies, they make polymers, nucleic acid, protein, lipid, carbohydrates, all mostly done by these chemically devised proteins. They can also do physical work. They can make motors which carry cargoes around the cell on protein-based trackways. They can act in hybrid ways, combining chemistry and physics, capturing energy from sunlight or from breaking down sugars to produce energy-rich chemicals that drive all the activities that cells need to operate. Now, what does this mean? It means that the thousands of chemical reactions being carried out simultaneously and close to each other in living cells. I put up here just a fraction. Each of these dots is a chemical reaction that the biochemist stroke biologists in the room will know what this is. In the middle here is the Krebs cycle. There are hundreds of reactions going on this limited part of life's metabolism. And all these reactions, all of which require somewhat different microenvironments to work, are going on simultaneously all the time in all cells at this moment in your body all the time. Now, how is that possible? It's only achieved by compartmentation. And this compartmentation is brought about by the surfaces and folds of the enzymes themselves, by complexes of enzymes acting together, and by membrane-bounded organelles, which we can see in the cell. Now, I wanted to emphasize that, because when you look at a cell, you think, oh, these are bits that make up the cell. I'd like you to think of them as actually organized compartments, organized microchemical compartments that allow hundreds, if not thousands, of chemical reactions to occur simultaneously. Because without that compartmentation, that could not work. It's schematized here in this one, which is probably from Scientific American, where you can see some of the compartments that are actually there. Generating the different chemical microenvironments required for the elaborate chemistry of life to take place. Now, that allows the chemistry to take place. But remember, the cell and all life has to operate as a whole. And that means that these different chemistries have to talk to each other. If they're not talking to each other, then they cannot behave and act as a whole. And that talking to each other is communication transfer of information, which leads to my next idea, is life as information. And life as information is reflecting the fact that living things are complex systems, that we need in those complex systems control for it to work properly together, and that leads in turn to purpose, that you see something happening which has a higher purpose than what the chemistry itself is providing. Surprisingly, the idea of life as a complex system was first argued by the philosopher Immanuel Kant. I was taught this when I was at the University of Sussex, and I didn't believe the person who told me. And it's true, there's 30 pages of his book on moral philosophy, which talks about life as a complex system in 1802. And nobody, of course, picked up on it now. And now we talk about system biology and so on. And I don't think most know it had its origins 200 years ago. Now, the operation of a complex system requires management of information. It's only possible by managing information, by having properly controls. And I operative. And I'm going to give two examples to illustrate this. The first is to return to DNA. You remember this, the double helix. Now, the structure of DNA is iconic, it's beautiful, though I get tired. Every time I go into a biological research institute, you immediately see a double helix. So when I put up the crick, I said, I don't mind what art we put in there as long as it looks nothing like a double helix. Now, it's beautiful, but its real beauty lies in the fact that it only makes sense when it's realized that this molecule is in fact a digital information storage device. It's written, as I've already said to you, in the linear script of four letters. This linear polymer DNA is ideal for storing information, and the encoding bases being turned inside are protected from chemical change. And as I've already explained, but I wish to emphasize and therefore repeat, this information can be turned into chemical action that can do work by encoding the chemical activities of the proteins, as I've explained to you. For me, this is absolutely wonderful. It's a wonderful characteristic of life. The carbon-based polymers have both abilities to encode information in one-dimensional stable linear structures and to carry out chemical and physical work in three-dimensional chemically active structures. And it's worth pondering about. I was taught this at school, university, and everywhere, but I somehow only sort of realized this in recent years. Second example I want to discuss is regulation. That is making complex systems in living organisms act as a whole to be able to behave in with purpose. Now, to understand what I'm saying here, I'm going to go to man-made machines. And you may be like me, I sort of understand most machines that were made before 1900 and increasingly less and less machines that were made after 1900. This is a picture I took on a steam boat in New Zealand, I think, and the boat was built in 1896 or something like that, and it had a beautiful governor. This is a governor. What does this do? It was invented by James Watt in the 18th century, and as the engine goes faster, that spindle goes faster, the balls are centrifugal force, they lift up this valve here, and that regulates the steam going into the engine, and that slows the engine down. The balls go back in, and it puts more steam in, and the engine goes up again. It's a homeostatic mechanism designed to maintain a constant speed of the steam engine. It's man-made. It's designed to do this purpose, and that's what it does. It's essentially a negative feedback loop, the top up there, which is shown in the context of a metabolic pathway in a cell. Just imagine that you have three chemicals, A being turned into B, being turned into C by different enzymes. As C accumulates, imagine it inhibits the enzyme that catalyzes A going to B. Then if you get too much C, it will switch off its production, it will drop, and it will maintain homeostasis, negative feedback. And that is something that is used frequently in living cells. It was well demonstrated by a brilliant pair of French geneticists, François Jacob and Jacques Monod. I had the privilege of spending some time with Jacob earlier in my life, who worked all of this out studying the regulation of sugar metabolism in bacteria simply by genetics, abstract thinking, and brilliant models of how it might work. Other control modules, and I'm going to call them modules, for example, lead to a positive feedback loop. That means as C accumulates, it activates the A to B enzyme, and so you get more of C. And what this is like a switch. Once you start going, you rapidly go from one state to another. Now, many such feedbacks and controls modules operate in cells. They maintain homeostasis. They generate switches, timers, toggles, oscillators, translating the chemistry into informational modules. So you're going from chemistry now to managing information. And they can be linked together to generate more elaborate routines of informational management. I want to put this up as a metaphor for this. This is a transistor radio, and some wit has put these red and yellow labels, which are genes involved in cancer, actually, just to show that the network that we have designed in a radio or a smartphone or whatever has similarities to the network that we see in life. Must be said, though, a better metaphor rather than hardware is Dennis Bray's proposal that it's wetware. Why does he say wetware? What he means is these components are all hardwired together. So you can't change the basic structure. You can change the inputs and the outputs and you can get regulation. But wetware connects the different components by diffusion through liquid. And that means you can rewire the hardware for different purposes. And that's something I suspect we haven't yet thought quite enough about. But it certainly has the potential to increase the versatility of these control modules. Now, the management of life's chemistry by information allows the behavior of the complex system to act as a whole. And that means it can act with overall purpose, such as reproducing a cell, making a butterfly, maintaining our cells. So key here is life as chemistry, life as information. Now, for centuries, generating purposeful behaviors in living things was thought to require a designer, a divine creator. It took evolution by natural selection to change this, and that's going to be the final idea that I'm going to discuss with you before trying to pull it together. Now, evolution by natural selection, how living things come about. Now, this beautiful idea, and it is a beautiful idea, probably the most beautiful idea in biology, mainly due to Charles Darwin. The idea has two parts, actually. The first is that life evolves over time. The second is that a major mechanism for that evolving, for evolution, is natural selection. Now, that life evolves was not really Charles Darwin's discovery. It had been around quite a lot before that. We have Charles here on your right, and this is his grandfather, Erasmus Darwin. And this idea that life evolves was discussed for 50, 60 years before Charles by Lamarck, Jean-Baptiste Lamarck, who's gets rather a bad press today, but actually he was a very good biologist, and Charles's own grandfather, Erasmus. Now, Erasmus was a colourful character. He was a scientist, a doctor, a poet. He wrote most of his research up in poems. I collect books, and I've got a number of 18th century books, all written in poetry. He wrote quite a famous book called The Loves of Plants, which is all about plants fertilizing each other, couched in sort of classical illusions. He was a Republican, He was asked to be George III's physician, which he refused to do. He was a proponent of women's education. He was had a terrible stutter, but was a great conversationalist. He also argued for the evolution of life, and he suggested that simple, formless life, like mollusks found in a shell, could evolve into complex animals. And so he had a motto on his coach, which said, "Everything from shells." Now, he lived in Lichfield at the time, and he was in the cathedral close, and the dean of Lichfield didn't like this very much and began to preach against him and his wealthy patients. And because he was also quite an idealist, he didn't charge his poorer patients. His income depended on his wealthy ones. And because he was getting a disrespectful reputation, he had to paint out his motto from his coach. Anyway, read about Erasmus, really interesting. Charles was actually a rather more moderate sort of individual compared with his grandfather. Now, the evolution of life, that life changes, implies there's a tree of life, that living organisms are related. If life only arose once and only survived once on the planet, as seems likely given the conserved chemistry and coding that we find, then all life on Earth is related. This is captured in the only illustration in Darwin's Origin of Species, published in 1859, where he illustrated the tree of life. He wasn't quite sure whether life originated more than once. Look at the bottom, A to L. He was he didn't quite know about it. But here we see a clear tree of life. He gathered evidence in favor of this during his trip around the world in the Beagle. And he proposed a mechanism, natural selection. Now, briefly, what is natural selection? It's based on the facts that populations of a species, of a living organism, exhibit variations. And if these are caused by inheritable genetic changes, which can be caused when the DNA is not copied precisely, or if DNA is damaged by external causes. If these variants then influence characteristics that can make these organisms more successful, then in principle they will reproduce more, and that particular genetic variant will spread through the population. Over time, such variations will accumulate and lead to sufficient changes in that population, such that the individuals will no longer be able to breed with examples from the original population, leading to a new species, accounting for the title of his book, The Origin of Species. Darwin concluded this in part by his studies of finches in the Galapagos. For those, and I like to think I didn't invent this, I'm afraid I stole it, but it's a great metaphor, isn't it? So some finches had evolved to crack nuts, others to seek insects under bark. And what we have here are pliers that basically have the same structure but are designed to do different things, like strip wires or wrench things. And these were intelligently designed, and these were designed by natural selection. The fact that these are intelligently designed, and these, of course, are designed without an intelligent designer, is the reason why Darwin is still contentious, because it removes the need for a divine creator. Now, I'm going to push this a little further. For natural selection to take place, three things are needed: reproduction, a heredity system, and a heredity system which exhibits variability upon which selection can work. Let me show you how this can work on the ideas of simply the cell and the gene. Imagine a single-celled life form with a brown coat. Imagine the brown coat is encoded by the DNA. Imagine there's a mutation which results in the brown coat becoming a red coat. And imagine the red coat does better than ones with brown coats. Perhaps they can't be eaten so easily. Then what you can see is, by combining the idea of the gene and the idea of the cell, you automatically get evolution by natural selection. These three ideas are all closely linked and can give rise to the variety of life. This is an important idea, so much so that the 20th century geneticist Hermann Muller used it to define life, and that's going to be the starting point for the principles that I'm now going to draw together. He defined life as living things have properties which allow them to undergo natural selection and therefore to evolve. So he simply took Darwin's definition and turned it into a definition of life. And this definition is one I'm going to use in the final part, talking about the principles. But first I want to say goodbye to Darwin when he was an old man. You have to, this is the last sentence in The Origin of Species. Whilst this planet has gone cycling on according to the fixed law of gravity, from so simple a beginning, endless forms, most beautiful and most wonderful, have been and are being evolved. I wish I could write papers like that. The editors, of course, would scrap it out and said, far, you know, superfluous, superfluous. Also note that he's linking himself to Isaac Newton and that biology can have laws just like physics. Now, I'm going to turn to core principles, but I want to have 2 minutes on viruses. Because viruses are always troubling when, well, actually, they're very troubling at the moment. But viruses are also troubling conceptually in and by thinking about them, I think it will clarify us how we should think about life. Now, viruses, this is a bacteriophage, which infects bacteria, actually, have a nucleic acid genome, DNA or RNA. They have genes important for the virus. They undergo evolution by natural selection, which is why influenza changes each year. So pass Muller's test. But they can only reproduce when they're inside the cells of other host living organisms. And they do so by hijacking the cell's molecular machinery to copy itself. This means a virus cannot operate separately from its host. The cellular environment of its host is completely dependent upon another living entity. So the question is, are they alive or are they not alive? Now, in thinking about this, I think it's important to remember that other forms of life are also, to a greater or lesser extent, completely dependent also on other living beings, which is something in this debate that we don't often consider. Many parasites live on or inside the cells of bodies or animals, plants or fungi, although their dependency is less total than for a virus. Our cells, we can't make certain amino acids. We must obtain them from other living organisms. Even free living microbes like yeast are dependent upon molecules usually made by other living organisms, albeit simple ones like glucose and ammonia. Plants are more independent. They use the energy of the sun to make biomolecules. But even plants rely on bacteria found in their roots to capture nitrogen from the atmosphere. Perhaps the most free living organisms are the cyanobacteria, single-celled microbes that can capture both carbon and nitrogen from the atmosphere and work on the energy from light. Now, I mention all of this, so you can see there's a graded spectrum of living organisms from the viruses through to plants with a wide range in between, and these all have varied dependencies on other life forms. In the case of a virus, the dependency is very strong, whilst in other organisms, that dependency can be weak. But I argue that these different life forms are all alive because they all can evolve by natural selection. If you don't like that explanation, I'll give you another one for viruses. They're dead when they're outside the cell, and they're alive when they're inside the cell. So that's another solution to the conundrum. Now, the conclusion I want to draw from this is that life on Earth is fundamentally connected, both through being related as a result of evolution, the tree of life, and also through these deep relationships and interdependencies and interactions that I've just very briefly summarised. Now, with this in hand, a big breath, I'm about to finish, we're going to have a few principles which reflect what we've said. Now, I said that explaining these ideas will help us establish principles. Let me summarise where I think we've got to. I'll start by reminding you what living organisms do. They maintain themselves, they grow, they self-organise, they reproduce, they have heredity. So this is what they do. At school, we're just taught what they do, but we're going to try and go a bit further than that. This is all brought about by evolution, by natural selection. The central principle for life that I think is important is the one by Müller that I just explained to you. Living things are entities that can undergo evolution by natural selection. Once you have that, then you can evolve diversity and you devolve purpose, you get things that work. They acquire purpose, they are entities that build, maintain, and reproduce themselves. Living things evolve because they have the following attributes. They are also bounded, separate physical entities based on the cell as the basic structural and functional unit of life. They have a heredity system, which determines how the entity functions, that is copied every time the entity reproduces. The copying is precise, but exhibits variation. Variation that natural selection can work on. If it was absolutely precise and DNA was never damaged, we'd have no evolution. So it's a balance. Life is based on carbon polymer chemistry. This is the basis of the lipid membranes that surround cells, that can generate order and organization, the carbon polymers that make up DNA and RNA, the proteins that make enzymes and all the chemistry we need for life. Polymer-based chemistry gives rise to digital information devices, storing information in linear chains that can be translated into chemical and physical devices and machines. Integrating all these functions requires the management of information. Inputs are gathered from within and from outside the cell, processed, stored, and then instruct cells and organisms to behave in ways that allow them to maintain themselves, grow, and to reproduce. Now, should we ever encounter life elsewhere in this universe, I suspect it will be based on rather similar principles. The details may be different. It could involve different chemistries, perhaps not based on carbon. However, in my opinion, for it to readily serve the need for both long-term information storage and diverse chemistry, I think polymers are likely to be involved. The life forms will require energy sources. This energy could come from the nuclear reactions within stars, light and heat, or geothermal energy within planets circling stars. But to return to our planet, this is the only corner of the universe where we know for certain life exists. The life that we are part of is extraordinary on Earth. It surprises us. It has bewildering diversity. Scientists are making sense of it. And that understanding makes a fundamental contribution to our culture and to our civilization. I want to emphasize that. It contributes to our civilization. Biology shows that all life, including ourselves, is related to each other. It's deeply connected to all other life. We share much with this yellow brimstone butterfly. Now, as far as we know, we are the only life forms who can see this deep connectivity and can reflect upon what it might mean. In my view, this means that us humans have a special responsibility for life on this planet, made up as it is by our relatives, some close, some more distant. We need to care about it, we need to care for it, and to do that, we need to understand it. And that's what I've tried to do in this lecture. So thank you very much.
So let me begin by thanking Paul for a really stimulating lecture. We now have a little bit of time for question and answer. I need to remind you that we're being filmed. So if you're not meant to be here, then perhaps don't ask a question. When you do ask a question, if you could wait for the microphone to get to you so it can go into the recording. And I'm really sorry, the people on the upper gallery, we won't be able to get a microphone to you. And so if you can begin to wave, and perhaps the first person can go there. While we're doing that, I'm going to take prerogative, chairman's prerogative, and ask the first question. And Paul, you talked about the language of the genes, that it's written in four letters. And of course, we're just coming to the threshold where we're going to be able to change that if we want to, increase the vocabulary in a sense, and to do things within synthetic biology. I wanted to ask you the degree to which you're excited about that, nervous about that, and what it might be able to do in terms of new science and producing new things, and also whether it might give any insights into the questions that you so clearly outlined in your talk.
Well, I think the people doing this are absolutely brilliant. I mean, for those maybe not familiar with it, it's the ability to construct what are called orthogonal codes, which actually allow living devices to be made that don't depend on the details. It's the same principles as we talk about here, but the same details. And so this may have the potential to broaden the ability of living things to do different sorts of things, in particular different chemistries, which is where synthetic biology has been discussed, that producing organisms that might do more useful things. I have a feeling it's not going to be quite as useful as it's sometimes argued. And that just may mean I'm just too old and white-haired and not imaginative enough. I think it's brilliant work and we should do it, and it may work to produce new things. I think it will produce some new things. But I think we have yet to explore the extraordinary diversity that life is capable of simply by manipulating what we have already. So I don't see it yet as the big shift that some do, but I think it will add something to that. And what is absolutely sure, certain, is the people who have done it are absolutely brilliant. They're doing wonderful work, which I couldn't have imagined 20 years ago.
Thank you. Do we have a question? Go ahead.
Thank you. In your view, can information be stored exterior to DNA, but within the organism? And secondly, briefly, if I may, are you satisfied that we can define easily precisely what the organism itself is? Thank you.
What was the second part again?
Can we define satisfactorily exactly what the organism itself is?
Well, I think you could imagine information being stored in different sorts of ways. Indeed, many around 1950 thought that it was encoded in protein structure, for example, and in a sense there is information that is stored there. I personally think, and I argue quite strongly, that for versatility and for ease of operation, that it's stored, it'll be stored most readily in linear form. And we see that everywhere. You know, I'm speaking in linear form. But you could design, and indeed the synthetic biology approach is to design different ways of doing it. So I could conceive of it being different from DNA. We have storage in RNA, for example. It's still a nucleic acid, but it's a different molecule. We have information stored outside the nucleus, which is not what you were saying, but we have that in the mitochondrion, which was probably a captured microbe from 1,500 million years ago that persisted. So we do have different hereditary systems. Now, the second question I still didn't quite catch, which I think was to do with definition of an organism. Well, the way I tried to define an organism was not a dictionary style of definition. It was to share principles that I think we should think about. That approach isn't quite the same as the way that we define organisms at school, which I hinted at, is to say what organisms do. It was to try and dig deeper as to what the principles are. I think Muller's definition of evolution by natural selection is a very unifying one. I think you have to deliver that program that gets you into chemistry and information. And I think that you need something to do it in, which gets us into cells. I think once we've sort of taken all that on board, I think we have a reasonable basis for thinking about what organisms are. But I agree it's not a dictionary definition. The Oxford English Dictionary would have a page on it if we had to take this on.
Thank you. I think someone has a microphone up there.
Yeah. Hello.
Can you wait? Hello, where are you?
I can't see you. Right up there.
Yep.
Hello.
Hi. So all of the properties that you ascribed to life, one could imagine a computer program being written that displayed all of those properties. Like you can make evolving computer programs fairly easily. Would you consider computer programs that have all of those properties to be a form of life, or do you think that the physical substrate matters, or is it more of like a structural property?
Well, you're quite right. We have programs that evolve by natural selection. So some people have argued that in some sense this might represent life. I did sort of, anticipating the question, I did sort of stress at several stages that we needed a physical entity that could do it itself. Now, in the sense of a computer program, it is also reliant on another life form, just to go back to the interdependency. In this case, a human being that creates the computer program, but also creates the hardware in which it works. So the way I sort of push a computer program to one side, although fully acknowledging that it has some of the characteristics that I described, is it is not a physical, independent entity which is doing it itself. It is working within a medium, as you fully understand, and within that medium, it's evolving in terms of its language is evolving, but it is not a physical, independent entity, I would argue. But that's certainly the point you make is made and cogently, and we have to think about that, just like we have to think about viruses. But for me, I'm including viruses as alive, computer programs as dead.
Thank you. Question here. Hand up.
I loved your repeated use of purposeful and purpose. And that's a very rich concept that can be used to mean sort of downward causation as opposed to a bottom-up reductionism, albeit with the need to address the challenge of overdetermination.
Yep.
All the way through to sort of purposes that one can find and choose and determine. And I wondered how you were using it and how you see a continuum all the way through to us who certainly feel as if we're biological beings who can choose purposes.
Yeah, no, so that's an insightful question. We think we behave with purpose all the time. Sometimes our purposes seem utterly trivial. And that should not divert us in some ways from the sort of purpose I'm talking here. Jacques Monod, who I mentioned, coined a term for it. He gave it a fancy term so we didn't get confused with purpose. He called it teleonomic, which is purpose in the sphere of biology rather than human behavior. So that's to make some distinction there. But I want to explore a bit more of what you were saying about levels. Because purpose occurs at different levels, and purpose, that is behavior of the system as a whole, lifts you from chemistry into biology. A chemical reaction is not life. The replication of DNA that we can do in a test tube isn't life, but the purposeful behavior of a cell is, and somewhere in there is a transition from chemistry to biology. And I think that's something that is worth thinking about, because I'm not quite sure where that transition occurs. But there's something else to do with these different levels, which I think is interesting. I mentioned life as information. Now, at different levels of life, from molecular assemblies to cells to organs to organism to populations to ecosystems, are all complex systems, subject to similar laws when they are reduced to the management of information. And what I happen to think is that what we may learn in terms of the management of information at the level of molecules will turn out to be relevant in an ecosystem, and what we learn in an ecosystem will be relevant to the behavior of molecules, which is why I think we have to focus on biology as a whole system when we teach it, and not have molecular biologists and botanists and zoologists or whatever, which we're reversing a bit now, but was a real problem. So I think the unifying way of thinking about this is the management of information at different levels. Isn't quite the question you asked, but I'm glad to be able to make that point too.
That's very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. Lady in the striped jersey.
Hello. It feels like yesterday, but it was actually a few years ago, you gave a wonderful lecture in this room. I think it was the Remains lecture.
Ah, yes.
And it was called, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, Four Great Ideas in Biology.
Yes.
The cell, DNA...
You're telling me I gave the same lecture?
No. I thought you were going to give the same lecture, but then you didn't. And you'll remind me what
yes,
the four great
right.
ideas
I,
were.
I did, yes.
And then you went, and I think there's a fifth. And yes. Most of what you were talking about today was a fifth. So it was the fifth. But I wonder if you could just summarise what... For people like me, for whom the fifth part was all completely new, what the key factors are that weren't there in your Remains lecture. It was information and the linearity and the folding. Something.
Well, I'm embarrassed you were present at the Romanes lecture because I was rather hoping nobody would be here so that it wouldn't look as if
well,
I was giving...
It was so good I had to come again.
you're quite right that it was that was a precursor to this, but it evolved by natural selection to take on a more important problem. I was interested then in just identifying some of the ideas of biology in a way to generalise about phenomena, which, as I said at the very beginning, us biologists are rather reluctant to do. But what I have realised over the years in thinking about it is that this is a way of thinking about what life is, and it also made me think more carefully about the things that you brought up. The linear code, the turning it into three-dimensional action. You know, chemical inertness, but storing information to chemical activity. None of that was there. Information wasn't there. I didn't have Muller's definition there because I hadn't read it then. So, but you're right. It was built on that. I'm writing a book on it actually, a simple book. I mean, well, I think it's simple, and it will come out. So it's all laid out there. And I say more things than I said tonight. But I still have a brimstone yellow in it. Butterfly.
Question there. Paul, the embodiment of Erwin Schrödinger in Oxford today is Tim Palmer, the physicist, who's going to ask the next question.
Paul, I'm going to betray my ignorance here, but probably the last time I read a book about DNA, popular book, I have to say, was about 20 years ago. Mm. And I remember the phrase junk DNA, that sort of 98% or something.
Sidney Brenner.
Was
Sidney
junk
Brenner.
DNA. I just wonder what, and it often struck me that was an odd thing to happen, that so much of our structure was somehow irrelevant. What's the thinking today? Is it still this junk DNA, or does every piece play a vital role?
Well, you're quite right. Junk DNA was, I think, invented by Sidney, if I remember rightly, who had a witty way with words. Which meant that in this case it was probably slightly exaggerated. But what he was pointing out was that we had genes that encoded things, the proteins, and then in organisms like ourselves, we had big gaps in between, and they didn't seem to do anything. Now, in yeast, which you may remember is what I've devoted my life to, poor, pathetic person that I am, we don't have big chunks of DNA in between genes. It's very gene-rich. In more complex organisms like ourselves, there's lots of DNA in between, and that DNA is increasingly being revealed as having roles primarily in regulating the genes that are found embedded within it. And that has the potential to give a richer set of behaviours than if you don't have it. Now, I'll say something else for which I have no evidence, but that might be relevant to it, that if you have an organism like yeast, which is trying to divide as rapidly as possible, then it doesn't want to be replicating lots and lots of DNA that isn't doing very much. And so it's managed to get along fine by getting rid of that DNA, and I think Sydney therefore called it junk. We are rather more complicated than the yeast, believe it or not, and we can exploit everything about DNA and the stuff in between because we don't care too much about how fast our cells divide. So we haven't got to copy all that DNA and so on. So having all that junk DNA definitely increases the ability to regulate it in more complex and interesting ways. And I think it would be fair to say that we don't yet understand it well enough to have a whole picture of it. But to understand how all this works, we need to think about the junk as well as the genes, because it isn't junk.
Thank you. There's a question in the back there, the chap with the blue T-shirt.
Yeah, so the image you put up there of the butterfly, together with your discussion about information in biological systems, kind of brings up the idea of chaos theory. And I was wondering, do you think that there are intrinsic limits to how much biology we can understand that is put in place by deterministic laws, but laws that are of a complexity that lead to chaotic systems, that at a certain level of detail we cannot possibly hope to understand?
Well, I ponder on this, actually, and I'm beginning to think I'm too old. I'm not going to see it through, because I think you're right. And how can I put this? I'll put it like this. If we look at physics pre-1900, Newtonian physics, not completely divided in that way, it is a common sense world, the operation of balls hitting each other and so on. Then we have Einstein's relativity, 1905, and it's a bit strange. You know, if you go to Blackwell's, and there'll be quite a few popular books on relativity, and you buy them, at least I buy them, I read them, you understand it, you close the book, and then it drifts away. And it drifts away because it isn't really part of a completely common sense world. It's beautiful, very beautiful, but it's not part of a common sense world. And if you get over that, you end up with Schrodinger et al. And so on, and Heisenberg and so on, with the structure of matter. And you're in an Alice in Wonderland world, you know, where you know, things can be alive and dead at the same time. You know, cats can be, Schrodinger's cat is alive and dead simultaneously. And so this is a very strange world. Now, why do I use that as a metaphor? Well, that may be due to the fact that in physics you're looking at the very small and you're looking at the very big, and that it sort of moves it out of our common sense world. Now, biology is infinitely complex. It's very, very complicated. You know, people go on, I'm going to sidetracks, forgive me, but you know, people worry about reproducibility in biology, and then the next thing that the newspapers say, it's all fraudulent. They don't realize how bloody difficult it is, how varied biological material is, and how difficult it is to get experiments to work half the time. And that is because we're dealing with great complexity. And we don't understand that complexity. And I sometimes wonder whether the complexity is going to take us into a different world of the sort you were not describing, but on the edge of, where our normal common sense principles, let's call it, don't actually apply. And that we're going to need help from scientists who think in more abstract ways, like the physicists, to work our way through it. And when I said I'd like to see that time, because I think that will come, but I have a feeling it's going to be beyond my lifetime. So I think we're going to go into a stranger world in biology. Now, you asked the question, is there a limit? I sort of think we're going to understand how cells work. I'm not so sure that we're going to understand how consciousness works, certainly not in a straightforward way as a cell. So there may be a limit there that I struggle with, and for sure we're going to need the help of the humanities and all sorts of other areas to be able to deal with it. But I think we'll understand a cell, but it may take us to a strange world. I think you want to reply, is that right? You looked as if you were...
I think that's a very satisfying answer, thank you.
Well, on that note, I think we have to bring proceedings to a close. Paul, when you said biology and doing experiments is bloody difficult, I could see all the experimentalists in the audience. When a Nobel Prize winner says that, it makes all the rest of us feel so much better. This has been such a fun evening. Thanks so much for coming along. And please, everyone, join me in thanking Paul for a superb lecture. Thanks.